teaching, so next week will be the last week that I have planned at this point. We're going to talk about intelligent design, the movement of kind of pseudo-creation, pseudo-science, and trying to answer the question, is intelligent design science? Is it religion? Is it neither? And so we'll go through a discussion of that. So that'll be kind of interesting as well. Ties into a lot of what we're talking about today as well. Okay, let's open in a word of prayer here. Father in heaven, we do ask that you open our minds to your truth and you close our minds to human error, that you illuminate your creation even more fully through a little bit of a scratching the surface of this topic of biological complexity, information content, and the history of the human genome. And we pray that this would in total allow us to glorify you more and maximize the impact that we can have in our society, a society that claims to be scientific, a society that seems to worship reason and logic above you. We pray that this would give us a new set of tools to engage with our culture in a new way, to direct people who believe that we were created through only randomness and natural law, direct them toward you and toward your truth in a way that is actually more reasonable and more logical than the preconceptions of evolution. So we pray that this would allow us to reach someone that we have not yet reached in a loving and kind way with the gospel of Jesus Christ. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, today we're going to have a very brief discussion of biology, and just a particular part of biology. We're going to look a lot at the cell, the cells that make up our body and other living things. And so I call this biological information and genetic entropy. They're basically two separate topics. We'll cover biological information first, and then we'll talk just very briefly about genetic entropy. This concept that really comes from a book written by a biologist named J.C. Sanford. A very interesting book, and I would recommend the book. $10 on Kindle or something, and you can have it for yourself. But so I found this little comic. I thought this was funny for two reasons. One, so it says, you know, these cell phones looking at the picture of an old phone with cord and says, "That's right, dear, our ancestors had tails," right? Well, as my kids would say, someone memeified it. They actually made it even better. Next one, got the iPhone looking at the picture that says, "That's right, bro, our ancestors had buttons," you know? So you can keep going like this, right? What's interesting is this is used as a joke for evolutionists, right? But it's actually pointing at a very big problem with evolution generally, that they're taking some sort of form, right? The form of the phone with a tail, form of a phone with buttons, and the form of the phone with a screen, and say, hey, these are genetic descendants of one another. In reality, they were independently designed by human agents, right? So they're actually pointing directly to design of a phone by somebody, design of a phone by somebody else. They clearly were not, you didn't turn a phone with a cord through successive small changes of its programming into a cell phone that had buttons and then into a phone that has a touchscreen. Those were independently designed by humans using common components. And so that's what we are going to argue generally as Christians in biology, that we see just because animals have similar cells to us, it does not necessarily mean that we had to have come from a common ancestor, right? We could have been designed using the same parts, same types of parts, just like cars. You see cars, they're not genetically linked from one generation to the other, but humans can design them using similar components and tools. So we can suspect that God would have done the same thing. He'll reuse biological components that are genius to begin with in all parts of his creation. So it does not say that the form of an object or even its function of the object necessitates a genetic linking through history, through evolution. So I think that's a misnomer. Okay, anyway, that's a little aside to what we're really talking about in this biological information. But what we're going to talk about, first of all, I want to review information a little bit. Remember, we had a discussion about information and how it was related to, in some sense, the content of a message, right? The amount of information in a message is related to how complex that message is. If you have a message that's, you know, it's an entire dictionary-sized book filled with the letter A, repeated page after page, You say, well, that's a pretty low information content object, right? I can write a computer program to say, okay, print A, repeat, 42,000 times, and that's it. That's the whole content of this book. Very, very small, this compression. You can compress it down very small. And in this sense, then we had the discussion about randomness. According to an information theorist, a random book filled with random letters, has maximal information content. Now, it's confusing to what we normally think of, because we think of information as conveying some sort of meaning. And so information theorists will wrestle with this as well. So there are these two opposing concepts of information. One, clearly it contains no information because it's a message that's repeated over and over and over again, and it only has the letter A. Or it is purely random, in which case we know it conveys no information to us because it's only random. However, if you now put the mechanism of the decoding and encoding into that message, so who's listening, who's sending, what is the language they're speaking, if you wrap the transmitter and the receiver into that whole communication structure, now we can start talking about meaningful information transfer. So we're going to have these confusions again in discussing with information, because biologists can't uniformly agree as to how much information is contained in a human cell, or a cell of any type, or DNA, because we don't fully understand the sender and receiver of that information. Now, it's ongoing research to say, how does the cell itself use the DNA, which is kind of universally believed to contain most of the information of the cell, how does the cell use that? And it's really complicated. We've only recently sequenced the entire human genome, right, the Human Genome Project, and actually led by Francis Collins, who is a Christian, which is interesting. So he's got some interesting quotes about that project. Only in the last few years have we fully sequenced many other genomes and then compared them to one another. And some of the main conclusions from that is that what used to be considered junk DNA inside of your DNA actually does get copied and is useful, which is surprise, surprise, right? So biologists used to say, well, 99% of your DNA has to be junk DNA because it would be mutated and evolved through the time, and so only a little part of it must be coding us. And now what they're realizing is almost all of it is useful for something, which that would be more consistent with a biblical model where an intelligent designer intentionally put some sort of programming in there to perform some sort of function. So that's pretty interesting there. But what we found in our discussion previously of information is that physics itself preserves information in the universe. Okay, so this is going to be a core concept here, that you cannot create or destroy information using natural law. It doesn't work. In order to create information, the only thing that we know of that does that is some sort of agent, a mind. Now, there will be arguments as to whether we can create information or if we are just processing external information as well. But at least it'll tell us that we should go all the way back to the source at some point and say, if the universe contains information now, which no one will dispute, right? If you say, does the universe contain information? Yes, the universe is not just a book filled with the printed letter A from side to side, right? We have complexity. We clearly have laws that are built into nature. We have our body, our organisms that are reproducing and have all this complexity in there. Plus we have us that we can communicate and generate information and have meaningful conversations. So clearly information is a large part of who we are as humans. That has to be explained somehow, according to the natural law. Now, biologists don't do that part. They push that out of biology, essentially. And so we just will remember it because it does provide a very good talking point to biologists who want to argue that somehow natural selection in the evolutionary process has created the genetic information that is inside of us. So keep that in mind, and we'll revisit this. Okay. What we know then in the complexity of information transfer of messages is that structure, or complexity of structure, is highly related to the amount of information that's contained in that object. Okay, so whether it's the Chronicles of Harry Potter, you say, well, okay, clearly there's information in here that one book is not the copy of the next. They're different volumes, and so they have a different amount of information. Those are a complex structure as a unit. So what we'll find is that biological systems look like this. They look like complex structures that when, you know, if you drive into a new area, that you, let's say you've never been to Kansas City. So you drive to Kansas City, you're driving down the freeway, and for the most part you see corn, but then all of a sudden you see a city. You're like, well, wait a second, that's really highly evolved corn, right? It's super complex, but I'm not sure that's Kansas City yet, because it could just be apparent complexity. We don't think that way. We see a skyscraper, you're like, that was built by a human. We have zero doubt that that was not a natural occurrence of just a rock formation that happened to fall down in a pile of a skyscraper, right? So we can recognize complexity. We're very good at recognizing complexity. In fact, how many people have been hiking? You walk down a path and you see like even four stones piled on top of each other. You ever see this walking around? And what do you think when you see that? Oh, someone's been here before. That's four stones piled on top of each other, you know, maybe large to small. And you say, that's too much order for it to randomly have happened. And yet biologists will somehow claim that randomness, the structure we see in our biological organisms, have to have come through some sort of random process like this as well. There's a caveat on there. I'm being a little bit rude to them, but we'll address what that caveat is. And that's the caveat of natural selection. It's what we talked about last couple times, because natural selection is intentionally a non-random process. So we'll get back to this. So you need a non-random process to create this complexity of organisms. All right, the simple cell. Who has recently taken a high school biology class? I'm looking over here, right? Okay, some people know biology, but way better than me. I avoided biology in everything after high school, right? I, in fact, avoided as much as possible in high school too. but what I got out of it is that the simple cell is anything but. It is not a simple structure at all. The more we understand about how even the single cells in our body or even in plants operate, they're exceedingly complex machines. So they're the structure of all of our living units, the functional units of living organisms. Of course, you can have single-celled organisms like bacteria, or you can have multi-celled organisms like us. And in fact, I read that the average cell size is 25 micrometers, which is about half the diameter of a human hair. Okay, that's the average size cell in your body, tiny. And if I calculate my volume, okay, I estimated my volume, divided by the volume of a cell, you get about 10 to 100 trillion cells in the average human body. That is a lot. I mean, that's a lot of cells. And it came from one originally, right? So it's an amazing process here of complexity and differentiation that happens in these multicellular organisms. But we're not even going to talk about multicellular organisms. We're going to look at that one cell. If you even look at that one cell, this thing runs like a factory. In fact, I've got a little slide later on I took from a YouTube video I'll show you. But basically, the cell itself, each cell, has to intake nutrients. It has to convert those nutrients to energy. So it has a little power plant inside that takes the energy and then it transports. It's got transport mechanisms. It has specialized functions that those cells will do. And then it has, it'll reproduce, and it has a waste mechanism. It has a way to get rid of dead parts of it and eject them. Incredibly complex. All right, I looked at a flow chart. I tried to find actually a diagram. I Googled functional flow chart of cell operation. There's nothing that comes up that is anywhere close to comprehensive. You can find little teeny cell functions, right? So, oh, here's the ATP transport mechanism. And it's this enormous flow chart. It looks like an engineering diagram, right? Here's all the structures. And then the next structured part, the waste removal part, and then the DNA copying part. They're so vastly complex, you can't put the whole thing on one page, right? And yet, we think of these as somehow randomly coming about. It's very, very difficult to conceive. Okay, so the cell is an exceedingly complex machine. I found this picture, which was really neat. So if you take the cell picture previously here, imagine taking a little tiny corner of the cell, that's the cell wall that's purple, say in the top left corner, and you cross-section it to look inside of the cell. That's kind of this blow-up on the left side. It comes from a textbook. There's this artist, Davis Goodsell. He does biological art. He makes paintings of kind of cartoon drawings of what a cell looks like in fairly good detail. He's a biologist as well. So I took an excerpt of one of these paintings I found online, and I'm going to move this little green box. So you see this green box over here on the left that's kind of on the black and white? That's going to slide to the right and show you an excerpt from his painting on the right. So it's a huge painting. And it's going to show you the intricate complexity of the structure only of what's going on inside of this cell. So you see the little green thing moving. That's the painting that corresponds to this little cross-sectional slice of the cell itself. You've got scaffolding membranes, you have these little protein coils, you have these viaducts between walls. This is like separation of waste to energy transport. You have then the mitochondria in there. You've got other scaffolding of parts that are constructing and copying DNA. I mean, the complexity of this thing is absolutely incredible. We've never made a machine that is as complex as the human cell. A single human cell, or a single cell of any type. We have 10 to 100 trillion of them in your body. We can't make one, let alone make it self-reproduce, right? The complexity here is amazing. If we could say, hey, I just developed a cell phone, and this cell phone, you just leave it around, it'll find its own energy, it'll get rid of its waste, it will function, it will heal itself if it gets injured. It'll defend itself against attackers on the outside. Oh yeah, and by the way, if you give it enough food, it'll make another cell phone tomorrow. Like, sign me up, I'm a billionaire, right? We've fixed the manufacturing problem. Logistics are done. So the complexity that is in every cell of the machinery is absolutely astounding. So there's a woman, Felice Frankel, who's in the chemistry department at MIT. She saw his art, and here's the quote that she said about this. She said, "I vividly recall first seeing David Goodsell's work about 12 years ago during my first visit to the Scripps Institute, where he's a research scientist. There it was, screaming at me through the art and illustrations surrounding me in his office, an aha moment, a revelation, in fact, that we've been doing it all wrong. Could our depictions of the cell have been, albeit unintentionally, deceptive and dishonest? Textbooks, magazines, and journal articles had been failing to tell the whole truth in their depictions of cellular structure. More important, they were sending out the wrong visual messages in the form of edited down diagrams that failed to communicate the cell's complexity. Perhaps if we were shown David's drawings as children, we would now have an easier time thinking about complex systems." So this artist basically could depict the complexity of the cell in a way that, if you've ever seen a biology textbook, you get this little cell here. Where is it? This one. Oh, that looks pretty simple, right? Those are functional components which are duplicated myriads of times, and then the complexity within each one of those is astounding. So we're not going to go into much more detail on there, except to say that this complexity is in the arrangement of the molecules of the cell, right? There's nothing in the material of the cell that's different than dirt, essentially. And yet how you arrange that dirt, right? The nitrogen, the carbon, the oxygen, all the other nice things in there, that arrangement is what we call complexity then. So, for instance, what's the difference between a trashy romance novel and the Bible? Truth. Touche. Touche, my brother. We wouldn't know, he says. All right. All right, let me say it this way. If you put them both in a blender, you get the same stuff out, right? There's nothing different in the chemicals used to make the paper or the printing or the, whatever. Maybe it's a little different in the weight or the mass or the quality. But what's really, truly transformative about the difference between these two is the arrangement of the molecules to make the pages say the words that we know that they need to say. So it's in the content, right? It's in the content, the information that's there. It's not in the composition, it's in the structure, okay? That's where the complexity is in the human cell as well, or in cells. It's not in the composition. It's all chemicals that you can find in soup, but I would hope that we're different than soup, right? Because of the arrangement of those, and that's the important part. And that's what evolution addresses. It addresses this arrangement of the molecules, because that's the big question. How did this arrangement come? There's no mystery how the molecule, okay, they debate how the molecules came about too, because there's some complex ones. But generally, the bigger question is, how did this get in the order we find it? It's like it's written like either computer code or a book that we're to read somehow, or the cell is to read and perform this function. Okay, this is the little snippet I took from the YouTube video. The reference is way down on the right there in garbledygook, but it'll be in the slides if you download them later. But essentially, I was intrigued by this. I searched Cell as a factory, and there's a pleasant Indian-sounding man explaining this whole thing to you. He talks about, this thing looks like a factory. Cell wall is the surrounding wall of the factory. You've got a guarded gate. You've got the cytoplasm, which is the area inside the factory. And then you've got the nucleus. The CEO's cabin, all the instructions for running the factory are in the nucleus of the cell, so like a central headquarters inside. It then dispatches messages through this Golgi apparatus. These proteins are addressed and dispatched, these packets containing the products that are addressed at the Golgi apparatus. I don't even know if that's how I pronounce it. Golgi? Golgi. All right, excellent. Thank you. There's a doctor in the house, so we can ask her. And then you've got the mitochondria and the powerhouse. There's a power generation factory inside. The incinerator, the lysosomes, where they take the waste, you dispose, you degrade them, and you eject them from the cell. And then the chloroplast implants, the kitchen, where the food's made, right? So this is the way this description was done. In 5 minutes, it goes through the whole cell and how it looks like a factory analogy. So it's really crazy how complex this is. Okay. So all of this, then, all of this complexity, yes, Ron?
I apologize. I'm just got my hand up.
That's okay.
That was one of the approximately 6 or 7 things that Darwin said. If the simple cell proves to not be simple, it will prove to be a fatal flaw to my theory.
You know, I tried to find that quote, and I found instead a person saying that Darwin did not believe that. And So what I was looking for, I mean, clearly this other person was pushing this avenue. In other places in Darwin's writing, he clearly talks about these sorts of mechanisms inside the cell as being complex, but I do believe that he still would have had trouble saying, well, yes, there's this complexity, but it still had to have arisen simply because it had to have happened quickly in evolutionary history and then happened multiple times. He felt that it had to have happened multiple times. So you're right. There is this myth of simpleness of the cell that has kind of been baggage dragged along evolutionary history for quite a while. There's absolutely no doubt to me right now that no biologist would claim that the cell is simple. So we can kind of discard that argument in some sense because, again, they don't say, well, I don't really care what Darwin believed. We're looking at right now his principles like Buddha stand, right? This is the idea. Who cares if Buddha really existed? It's the principles of enlightenment that matter, right? It's the same sort of thing with science. It's the same sort of mysticism of sorts. But it's a good point, though, that Darwin, in his theory, assumed that somehow the primary component of life would come about quickly and easily and then would be made more complex through this natural selection process. Okay, so inside of the cell, then, there is DNA. We've probably all heard about DNA. It is just a molecule, which is kind of crazy for scientists to think about, physicists and chemists, I should say, because we think of molecules as being very simple, you know, small joints of atoms together. And DNA, on the other hand, is this huge strand of a molecule. But a molecule is just, atoms and that are joined together into one single unit. And DNA is that, a big long strand, this double helix. It has some pretty amazing complexity itself. We won't go through a lot of this, but this quote by this, it's a NASA scientist. He's in the Astrobiology Institute at NASA. His job is to try to figure out the origins of life. He's also, however, ordained as a Methodist minister, which is interesting. So he wrote a paper which is actually pretty reasonable. It's arguing for evolution, but it has sympathetic to the arguments of intelligent design, I'll say. So if you're interested, there's a link to that paper, or you can actually search Stephen Freeland at the bottom there, The Evolutionary Origins of Genetic Information. There's a PDF and a website you can go to for some more information. He had this figure about DNA. Oh, the first quote in his paper is the definition of evolution at the top, and I really liked it. He says, biological evolution describes the natural process that transfers information from a local environment into the chemical known as DNA. So I think that is a really good definition of biological evolution in its core. If you're saying evolution, remember we talked about mechanisms of evolution different than the philosophy of evolution. If we're saying the mechanisms that scientists would study, it is this process. And it's fully acknowledging that there's an information transfer here. That's why I like this definition a lot. It says, it is the natural process that transfers information from the local environment to the DNA. Now, if that doesn't happen in evolution, then evolution, according to his definition, has been disproven. So that's the key. Does information transfer in this biological evolution process? So we've talked about the mechanisms. The one that we're going to focus on here, the biological mechanism, has to be the natural selection component. We talked about all these others, right? The other mutations and genetic drift, all of that, those are all random. The only thing that can create complexity out of simplicity, supposedly, is this natural selection process. So that's what we're going to focus on. Yes? Okay, let me get the first question, and then maybe I'll ask you to rephrase the second one. So the first question is, how does randomness know when to stop when it's gotten some sort of successful outcome or something, right? Yeah, and evolutionary biologists would be very careful to say, oh, no, it never stops, right? So that randomness is continuing right now. We just happen to be a snapshot of some sort of process that's always in flux. And so just because we think we're somehow the pinnacle of creation, you know, we have just too high of a self-opinion, basically. So we may agree with them on that, but the idea is that evolution is continuing to enhance and degrade organisms all the time without any directed purpose, and we just happen to be seeing ourselves right now in that process. So that's what they would say about that. Now, your second question was, I don't know if that answered your first question.
Yeah.
Okay, a little bit. I sidestepped your question, right? And what was the second one? Oh, okay. Those are the best ones. I don't have to answer those then. I had this trick in college when a student would say in class, oh, can you prepare for me a study sheet on something? I said, okay, send me an email to remind me of that later, and I'll send it to you. That decreased my workload by 90%. Put it back, it's like management, right? You put the monkey back on the person who came into your office with the monkey. You're leaving with the monkey, right? So anyway, okay. So if you think of your question, raise your hand again. So, got it? All right. Send an email. So DNA is kind of the programming language of the cell. Now, it's more complicated than that. When I was reading about DNA again, it's just so much more complicated than we come up with a model. We scientists come up with a model for what DNA is. Great, it's only 1% useful, and it's not really a programming code. It's this little loop. And they're like, no, actually, it's way more complicated, and it encodes. They think it now actually may encode information both forward and backward. So it's like a computer program that runs one program this way, and then you inverse the code, and it runs a different program that's useful as well. You're like, are you kidding me? I don't even know how to write that. So it turns out that DNA also then does not contain all of the information. It turns out that the cell environment for the DNA determines how the DNA functions as well, which we would expect. It is the computer on which the DNA runs. So there's no way you can take a computer program, print it out, and say, I know exactly what this is going to do, unless you know what that is supposed to run on, right? So if you remove it from the computer and you say, I'm going to run my program on my Apple iPhone instead of my IBM mainframe, you don't have any expectation that's going to work at all. So you have to know the environment in which the DNA is executing. So it's much more complex than just isolating the DNA and running the code. You say, we don't even know the computer it runs on. The cell itself is complex in that process. Yes? So I read about it. Can you explain it? What, can you define it for me? Because I forgot totally what it is. Right. Okay, I'll repeat the question, hopefully the core of it, and I think I can get it. Yes, the indications are in the fossil record, and if long evolutionary times are there, why have organisms stayed roughly the same over time in the fossil record? We don't see a lot of genetic variation and drift in species. And even in standard laboratory experiments where you genetically reproduce bacteria for 50,000 generations, they tend to be fairly constant in that process as well. So that's called homeostasis. Okay, appreciate that definition. I would say yes, they have addressed that. I think it's an ongoing question because there are clearly ongoing mutations that are going on inside of our own DNA that are both a part of the copying process in the biology as well as external factors that either have to be repaired. So evolutionists understand that damage has to be repaired in order for us to be as good as we are today. But beyond that, it even has to be beneficial mutations to cause complexity increase at some point. So I think that's an unaddressed problem is my guess, but I don't know actually. It's definitely a problem when they look at the fossil record. This is why Stephen Jay Gould had this model of this punctuated equilibrium where he said, look, the fossil record shows not enough transitional forms, maybe a few. Arguably, those were unique species themselves. But without a whole lot of transitional forms in the fossil record, what you get instead is the fossil record looks like, the sudden appearance of these species, and then they've stayed constant in time, piling up in layers of dirt, right? And that's really a big problem to this constant change model. So you're right. I think that's a big problem for those paleontologists and evolutionists. And Stephen Jay Gould got famous for his punctuated equilibrium model specifically to address the gaps in the fossil record. But I don't know. I haven't read all of his work to say, does he have a mechanism to explain this? I think he just said, it's evolution of the gaps theory, right? We've got a gap, and we're going to put evolution right here because it's invisible to us. So that is a challenge. When I read about, there are thousands of scientists doing work in this all the time, and they make incremental improvements year by year. But they're fascinating to read about, but they're extremely technical. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of the background for biology to understand most technical papers. So I have to go one step removed from that and do like review articles so I can understand what's going on. So I feel a little bit, handicapped in that process of seeing exactly what the state of the field is. So these books that come out 3 years later then are really nice for us because they kind of summarize what's going on in the field. And I'll reference one of them later. That's quite good. Okay, so this DNA determines a lot of the function, form, operations, the duplication, all of this, of these cells. It's written in a very simple code. It's written in a four-letter code, basically. It's a four-letter alphabet. So if we said all of the books that we read, they're in a 26-letter alphabet plus spaces and periods and quotes, so 30-ish symbols that we can write what we do. DNA is written in only four. So A, C, T, G, these nucleotides that bind to each other in this kind of zipper structure in a double helix so that it can be split apart and duplicated. So it's two copies that are next to each other, split, reproduce the part that was missing, and you've now got a copy of the DNA. It's very clever. You basically unzip the DNA and make it into a copy of itself in the duplication process. But the DNA alone does not determine all of the cell function, as I said. There's the computer that runs this code, as well as other more complicated things that it seems that a lot of this junk DNA that they said was in DNA, well, the reason they thought it was junk is that it's a lot of repeating patterns, low information content DNA. They're like, wait a second, there's 17 cells of the same thing over and over and over again through this DNA. You say, well, that clearly doesn't do anything because it's low information, right? Well, it turns out those are spacers for the structure of DNA such that when it copies or folds, it actually makes a complex structure itself to do some sort of other function, right? So it's actually beyond, it's like having a computer program that you print out the printout of, and you say, okay, great, I'm gonna match up every 14th line, and what do you know, I glue it together, I get a chair. You're like, what? Who thinks of this? So clearly a mind beyond us that does this sort of thing. So that's where they think, wow, we thought that most of the DNA could have errors in it that would not affect the function. In reality, they're finding even small mutations to what they thought was junk DNA has deleterious consequences on the organism itself. So it's more intricate than originally thought. And this came out only in the past 5 years because of this project called ENCODE, all capital letters. It was a group of people trying to sequence fully sections of the DNA which had not been done previously. So that's pretty exciting stuff. The only point here I want to say is that the language is simple, the chemicals are common. It's what is actually, sorry, the alphabet is simple, the chemicals are common. The language that the DNA is written in, we don't fully understand. And the grammar and the context, all of that is beyond us at this point. So it'd be really neat to see how these biologists discover more and more about how DNA is all kind of packed together and how it does what it does. We're not yet at the point where we can program from scratch DNA, right? That would be kind of neat. You say, oh, if I'm a computational biologist, the holy grail is I take the cell, I remove the DNA, I write my own DNA, I put it in, and I make whatever I want. It's like 3D printing from a Petri dish, right? So that's they're trying this, but the code is so complex we can't write it yet. But it's coming. It's maybe in our lifetimes. It'll be really weird. Because now you can have a little cell that you put in a Petri dish and you can grow whatever you want, right? It may not function for long because we're probably going to be very bad at writing the code compared to the person who made the computer, right? But we'll see what happens. Okay, so if there's this information content in our DNA, the natural question that we ask, and this what the second part is, this genetic entropy topic, there's this book called Genetic Entropy by J.C. Sanford that I did read 80% of and then skimmed the last 20% because I didn't have time to finish it this week, but I got the main point of his book. He's a Christian biologist who analyzes the kind of information content of DNA, in particular looking at these random mutation rates and how these mutation rates might affect the process of natural selection and evolution. So he's not an evolutionist, but he's trying to refute evolution using the mechanisms that biologists are using. And it's quite convincing when you read it, of course, to a non-biologist, it's probably more convincing. But the main thesis is a pretty easy one to grasp. Overwhelmingly, when there are mutations that natural selection is supposed to use to improve an organism, overwhelmingly, any mutation that happens to your DNA code will have a neutral effect on the organism, meaning it doesn't affect it positively or negatively. Because it happens in fairly small, minor places. If you've got trillions of these, books that are filling the library, and you go in and you change one letter in one book, and you say, what have I changed in the information content of this library? You say, well, not much, right? You can probably survive this. So that seems like that could be good for evolutionists. They say, oh, well, yeah, there are mutations all the time, but most of them don't do anything. Well, it turns out it's the Achilles heel for natural selection, because the fact that most of the mutations are invisible means that mutations in our DNA code, generation after generation, or exposure to radiation, or copying damage, or whatever it is, combining with in reproduction with others, whatever changes your DNA code has very little effect on our physical function, it's all kind of invisible to us, then how can natural selection be explained to be cleaning up that code, right? You get the idea? If you can't tell from the outside that you're a mutant, right? We all are, it turns out. Probably have 100 different mutations in our DNA for each one of us, each generation, 10 to 100, somewhere in there. We're all mutants. We're not like the code was when it started, or it was when it duplicated, but we can't tell. We all still function fine, which means that if I try to outrun that bear, my mutations don't cause me to lose the race, right? Which means natural selection cannot do anything to say this DNA is better than this DNA. You see how that works? If there's not an effect on the organism's function or form, if it's a mutation that's invisible, it just goes into the code and has no way for natural selection or evolution to have any effect on either cleaning it or selecting a better version. Okay, get that? So that's one of his main theses. The other one is that of those mutations that do cause a functional change to the organism, almost 100% of those are detrimental mutations. They cause disease and dysfunction. I mean, you look at You know, no one says, oh, you know what, I'm going to improve my function by going into a high radiation environment and see if I mutate properly, right? That's superheroes, but that just causes cancer in us, right? I mean, this is why we avoid radiation environments for that particular reason, because we don't see improvement to function this way. So he said he will agree that there are beneficial mutations occasionally, but those all then fall back into this non-selectable range of mutations for the most part, that you're not going to get any sort of external effect by even having a beneficial mutation. Okay, so what he does pretty clever work in there. He goes through a lot of literature to describe that and convince you of those points. And then at the end of the book, he kind of goes through a look at some other interesting points, which I wanted to show kind of quickly. But the main argument is that evolution claims that there's going to be an upward trajectory of information content in your DNA over time, right? An upward improving DNA fitness to the, you know, to the world, all that. You're increasing the complexity. In reality, if you look at anything that we know of, you get exactly the opposite. You have a decreasing complexity and fitness to our environment over time due to mutations. Because if you think about it, mutations are accumulating in our DNA all the time. We don't even know it, but they're being passed to our kids, to our grandkids, and those mutations eventually collide with one another. If you have recessive gene mutations, get two recessives together, oh, now you have a birth defect because these mutations and these mutations have combined. This is why inbreeding causes such big problems in the human population. If you have highly inbred populations, even recessive mutations are duplicated in the other population. So you get duplicate mutations in two populations in the same places in the DNA, you merge those, now you have a big bad effect in the population itself. So why would we want to claim that somehow these mutations are going to improve the fitness of the organisms this way? Yes?
Wouldn't that process also say that as you outbreed, try to use that term, you can actually push those mutations out?
Well, so there's nothing to select the mutations away. You'll always have them, but yes, by having... Yes, yes, that's right. They have to be transmitted. Yep. That's right. Some of them... That's right, that's right. So the point is the exact opposite effect should be there, that if you have mutations that are unique to these organisms and are not passed to their children, that by combining through sexual reproduction the DNA, you do clean up some of those mutations. That's right.
An easy example is a friend of mine had pigeons that were very bred to do certain types of things. But if he took the really selective pigeons and he started breeding them, you know, intermixed them, they come up with their street pigeons.
You reverted back to the original code. Yeah, you kind of cleaned it up to its original again, yes. Which was in that case, because humans selected the higher performers, you're going downward back to the common.
Or you might say, maybe
they weren't. Well, they were higher for our purposes, right? Yeah, yeah. So if you breed all your dogs together, we're going to get a wolf. So be very careful, right? So, all right. So you have two directions for possible historical DNA content. Either an upward trajectory of more information, or a downward trajectory from some sort of source of pure DNA, if we want to think of it that way, and being degraded generation by generation. And Sanford's argument is the biblical argument that we may have been created in a more pure state with few mutations, and that we've been slowly, as a generational population, becoming more and more mutated over time and degrading is more akin to what you'll see in the science. So he goes through some interesting arguments this way. A very quick look at this. He did an interesting plot. So he's a scientist, so he did two plots. One is, let's look at the lifespans of individuals in the Bible. He just plots them on a plot here, right? Well, it turns out from Adam to Noah, here are the lifespans for 10 generations that you get. Relatively constant, nice flat line. If a student fit that and said that's constant, I would give them an A on that. Pretty darn constant, right? 900 years, the lifespan before Noah. Okay. Do the same thing after Noah, and he fit it to an exponential decay curve, which is mind-bogglingly good. This fit is incredible, okay? When I look at this, I say, that is an exponential curve. Now, all mutational things that we do go with exponentials, right? They're random processes and they go with exponentials. So he takes this 900, 600 down here, way over there, 65 generations later is us over here, about 70 years, 80 years. So, you know, maybe he had to guess at some of these numbers. I take him at his word that he didn't fudge this data. You know, the ones that are recorded in the Bible are clear, but, you know, there's today, those numbers could be moved a little bit. But, I mean, what he's looking at is something happened at the flood that changed our mutation rates and the purity of our ability, the ability of the purity of our DNA to stay in homeostasis. That since the flood, we've had increased decay of the human genome. That's one of his arguments, right? And it seems pretty darn convincing from this. At least you can't argue with the decay, but the fact that it's exponential is actually, to me as a scientist, is really impressively crazy. So the argument here is, and there are some other arguments from the science as well, that that if you look at a pre-flood world that would have an enormous amount of moisture in the air, then you've shielded the planet much, much better from cosmic rays and ultraviolet and all these things that can actually cause a lot of DNA mutation in the surface organisms. So it's possible that's been cleaned up once all of that moisture comes out of the air. Yep. Yes? Amen. Yes, we are waiting not only for redemptions, the full redemptions of us, but the redemption of the land. The earth itself and all the life on it has been undergoing decay, right? This is pretty cool, right? This is really cool. You just look at the lifetimes. You say if the lifetimes correlate somehow to our genetic purity, this is pretty exciting. The other thing I realize is that if our generations were really, if the DNA is very pure, at the beginning of human creation, inbreeding has no deleterious effects. And you realize that has to be the case. If you start from Adam and Eve, and you're going to generate the entire population of the human race, you can't be having these sort of birth defects in inbreeding. Well, the DNA was pure. You don't have a whole lot of problems with that. Now you have huge problems with it. And so there's a time in the biblical history where that became taboo, right? You're not incest became a thing later because you had to generate the entire population from pure DNA. If people lived a long time and had kids for 800 years, that also helps that process because you're starting from the source material, right, and generating an entire line of populations with only one copy instead of many, many copies. It's very interesting. It's kind of circumstantial, but it was really intriguing to me when I looked into this. Yes, Ken. You know, that's a good point. So after the time of the flood, of course, you have this pinch point in the genetic population, right? So now you have inbreeding among the children of Noah and his family, right? And there's question about, you know, were the wives of Noah's sons related? We have no idea. And so even in looking at genetic code, tracing back to Adam and Eve from genetic coding that they're working on, which is kind of cool too, they say there are likely multiple lines of women that came at the flood, right? But they all point back to Eve. You can still find a common Eve and Adam in the DNA tracking, which is really cool, too. But science points to there being only two, right? Not multiple generations, multiple parallel people in the source material that have all separately evolved into the human race. There were two, right? That's pretty cool, too. Okay. We're going to have to end. What I do want to say is that when you engage then, so this all points, I believe, to, again, this sense of John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, right, the Logos, this information-containing spoken Word of God that created the universe in an ordered state, in perfection, and ever since there's been decay. And we look forward to that regeneration and rebirth of the planet without this decay, too. So when you engage evolutionists then, a couple arguments to avoid. Evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics. We've talked about this. No, it doesn't. Even if there's increasing complexity, the second law of thermodynamics requires a closed system. We have the sun giving us energy. We can't use that argument on the Earth. Okay? Random processes can't create information. True, but it's a non-random natural selection that it's claiming to create this information. So don't use that argument either. It won't be convincing to people. What we should talk about is point to the source of that information. Where is this information? If natural selection transfers information from the environment to the organism, where did the information in the environment come from? Just rewind. Where did this come from? Same thing with energy. We talked about the creation of the universe. Trace back the energy path. Trace back the information path, right? Where is the source of this information? You'll get a biologist to stop at some point. You say, I just don't know. I don't know where that information comes from. Now you've got them in an honestly confused state, and maybe they'll think deeply about what they believe. Okay. Bring in scriptural explanations of this complexity of life, morality, ethics, the things that will convict them that they don't know everything, and then in love, hopefully, share the gospel. So, all right, next week, is intelligent design science or religion? Okay, thank you. You're dismissed.